Let's do it.
Hi, this is Paul, and today with me is someone that many of you will recognize. This is Mary Harrington, and she's just released a book. I noticed that I can't get the book on Amazon USA yet, but I can get it in Audible, and it's Feminism Against Progress. And Mary's done a lot of very, very interesting interviews all over YouTube, and I've watched many of them. And when she talked to Glenn Scrivener, she had kind of an offhanded comment like, nobody's interested in my boring personal story. And I thought, no, I'm very interested in your boring personal story. I really don't think it would be boring. So I reached out to Mary, and she very graciously agreed to she had an hour that she could give me. And so I really appreciate, Mary, you coming on and us talking about it.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the home you grew up in. Did you go to church? Was faith a part of it? What kind of faith was in the home?
The short answer to that question is I was baptized Anglican, but I went to a Steiner school, which is to say, I think you would know them as Waldorf schools.
My wife teaches in one.
Ha, okay. There you go. You could. Yeah, I went to one of the older Steiner Waldorf schools in the UK. I don't know if it exists anymore, but it was very well established when I was there. I think it's probably fair to say I grew up in a fairly tight-knit faith community, but that was broadly Christian in its outlook, but in a kind of heretical way from sort of mainline perspective.
Now, you were baptized Anglican. Did your family attend church regularly, sporadically?
Not especially, no.
Okay.
With hindsight, relative to the way the rest of the world is, my school was 100% a faith community. You know, it celebrated the religious festivals, and there were weekly assemblies, yeah. Which by sort of contemporary, wider England standards were entirely spiritual, religious events. But it wasn't not in any conventional sense, and we didn't go to mainstream Anglican church, no. Okay.
And the Waldorf education or the Steiner education, I mean, so there's a lot of verse with that. Steiner's idea, it's sort of a, that's really interesting. This is why I do the conversations, because that's a really interesting piece of this. How do you think the Waldorf Steiner education shaped your worldview?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, of course, how could it not?
Yeah.
You know, you go to a, you're surrounded by. This is not a question I've tried to formulate on the hoof ever, let alone for a video in public. So let me think about how I would want to say this. I would characterize the sort of Steiner theology, and it is a theology, yeah. No question about that. You know, anthroposophy is a very distinctive outlook on the world. It's a kind of Christian inflected, it's sort of esoteric version of Christianity. For anybody who's watching this who has no idea who Rudolf Steiner is, he was a late 19th, early 20th century Austrian mystic and visionary, I suppose, who came out of the theosophy tradition, but sort of founded his own movement, a number of movements, actually, a lot of which are still very much alive in education, farming, and the care of people with learning disabilities, I'd say, were the sort of principal Steiner-influenced endeavours, which are still going strong, some with very interesting results, and often very positive results. So that was Rudolf Steiner, and I grew up around his ideas and around people who were very keen on his ideas, which I would characterize broad as sort of esoteric version of Christianity, influenced by 19th century theosophy with a side order of Eastern reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Crudely. So if you can imagine a kind of mashup between Lutheran Protestantism and Eastern mysticism, that's sort of like, that's somewhere in that zone. There are elemental, there's this incredibly complex cosmology, which I think there are three facets to the human soul. There's the physical, the etheric, and the astral. Yep. There's a whole doctrine of karma and reincarnation, which is just too complicated to go in probably here, which is, very, very non-standard from a sort of regular Christian perspective. Some kind of arcane stuff about, you know, several Christs, which I don't even fully understand, but, you know, so a lot of them are, they're very into kind of actually, I think ideas that come really out of some of the more sort of Gnostic currents, Gnostic mysticism, you know, sort of passed down via the Knights Templar and sort of disappearing into Eastern, disappearing into kind of medieval alchemy. And then it pops up again in Rudolf Steiner and is still alive and well in that tradition. So that's, I mean, since we're going there, that's my kind of esoteric heritage.
Well, it's very interesting given your work, how you've looked at industrialization and the Industrial Revolution. And in many ways, Steiner, you know, reacted pretty strongly to that. And his the development, the formation of his educational system, you know, really tried to, I would think, heal the wounds that industrialization was putting on children as they're passing out of traditional society. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
I'd never really, I wouldn't, not sure I'd have put it that way, but I think that's a good insight. There's definitely something to that. I mean, when I, if I think about, if I think about the biodynamic approach to farming, which is, you know, is very much, very much focused on trying to work with, I mean, it, you know, it's not dissimilar to what people call regenerative agriculture now. It just has more woo-woo, right? It just has more kind of, you know, esoteric bells and whistles, but it's essentially regenerative agriculture. You know, a meticulous approach to crop rotation and, you know, all of which works. I mean, biodynamic farming produces excellent results and really delicious food. There's no questioning that it works. And it swims radically against the tide of industrialization and, you know, the sort of reordering of everything to the market. So yeah, I think it's definitely fair to say that, you know, some of my sort of basic aesthetic and just kind of personal orientation toward the world is heavily influenced by a desire to honor those aspects of the created order, if you like, which are rendered invisible by turning everything into the standing reserve, turning everything into resources to be exploited. And although I wouldn't call myself an adherent to the Steiner theology, particularly, I think that sort of basic desire to honor what's left out of the market order, you know, comes it is you know accords fairly strongly with that perspective, you know, as you would expect, given that that's where I grew up.
How long were you? I know the UK education system is different than the American system here in Sacramento. It's rather unusual. The school my wife teaches in is kindergarten through eighth, and then there is actually a Steiner High School, and they're both public schools in Sacramento. So I don't think they are as self-consciously theological, given the fact that they're public schools. They're sort of Waldorf methods. A lot of people like it because then, you know, there are private Waldorf schools here, but they're fairly expensive. So were you in that all the way up until university, or?
Yeah, pretty much with the exception of a couple of years when we lived overseas and there just wasn't a Steiner school available, where I went to a regular local school. But apart from that, yeah, I think pretty yeah, well, Steiner all the way through.
What did your worldview look like in your teenage years?
I was not a happy teenager, so yeah, I was not a happy teenager, and I don't know that that was exactly school's fault. I mean, I think some people are just not destined to be happy teenagers, and the reasons for my being as unhappy as I was are complicated. But some of it was just down to the fact that, you know, I was the nerd. You know, and there's, you know, if you're in a small class, you know, it's a numbers game, and you're lucky if there's more than one nerd in a small class. You know, everybody else was just normal 90s kids doing normal 90s stuff, pretty much. And I was reading Nietzsche in the bath and ordering copies of Green Anarchist delivered to my parents' leafy suburban home. You know, it's ridiculous thinking about it. It's completely ridiculous. But you know, that I was, you know, now, of course, the kids who are like that will find each other on the internet, for better or for worse. I mean, you could probably argue the toss about whether that actually makes life any better. But anyway, you know, there was no such thing available for me in the early 1990s. So I was a nerd. So no, I was not happy.
In the beginning of the book, you talked about an experience of your mother clearing the table and your brothers not having to, and sounded like a moment of it was a moment of self-consciousness of suddenly an aspect of the world opened up to you.
I'm loath to go too deep into family dynamics because my family is still alive, right? And right. I don't think it's fair to expose the inner workings of a home that wasn't just shared by me. I think I've probably said about as much about the inner workings of you know my teenage homes as is appropriate for the rest of my family, those members of it who are still alive anyway. But yeah, I mean, for me personally, discovering that that sexed asymmetries kind of went all the way down into who was expected, or rather, you know, who was. I'll come at this another way. It wasn't so much that people that I was told to help do the dishes and my brothers weren't. That wasn't really how it worked at all. It was just that my dad would walk away, and after a while, my brothers copied. And I genuinely had the choice, I think, at that point as to whether I was going to walk away or whether I wasn't. And either way, it felt like somebody was going to lose. You know, there was a sort of zero-sum conflict in there. In a sense, I was failing in terms of solidarity to, you know, the other member of my sex within the family if I walked away. But I was also, in a sense, making a statement about my status within the family if I didn't walk away.
Right.
And that felt like a lose-lose.
Right. Really. Right.
And that, you know, feeling like that sort of, I mean, it's the kind of frustrating double bind that I suppose you get a lot in families.
Yep.
And it was one that just, you know, being the nerd I was, you know, I started looking for ways to think about it in books and in, you know, outside my own ruminations, you know, and I've found my way to Simone de Beauvoir, and I found my way to angry 1990s feminist indie music, and I found my way thence to all manner of other things. But I guess that was the point at which I became conscious. That and losing to my brother for the first time in an arm wrestle, which probably happened about the same time. But I became aware that sex really did matter, or sex really mattered in some subtle social ways, and also in some very concrete embodied ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, started trying to think through the implications of that for me, you know, either in the context of my family unit or in the wider world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's opened a set of questions which I've been trying to answer ever since.
Yeah. Now, nerds, frustrated and isolated nerds in high school in the pre-internet days usually really come into their own in college. What were the university years like for you?
Oh, I'm trying to think what was I like at university? I was very intense at university. I was quite probably a bit on the nuts side. I was completely on the nuts side. I was very, very intense. Tried lots of different things. I mean, I went to Oxford University. It's a very intense place. Probably still is, although I think it's different in some ways now. I wanted to do everything. I wanted to get the best grades and also do all the stuff and also throw the best parties and also just be the most on every possible front. And it kind of worked sometimes. And the rest of the time I was very intense.
And you write, you studied English, and
I did.
And then you in the book a bit, you talk about, you know, how you got into critical theory and how did that shape your worldview, not just in terms of, let's say, the theoretical map of the world, but your lived map of the world.
Yeah, immensely mind-warping experience coming across critical theory. I've written quite a bit about that since. I guess what was distinctive about it then, as opposed to now, critical theory has kind of eaten the academy to a far greater extent now than was. I mean, it was sort of a bolt-on. Oxford University in the late 1990s, early noughties, critical theory was kind of a bolt-on. You did it as an extra module in a sort of much more sort of classical study of, you know, Frog March through the English literary canon. And theory was a bolt-on that you did rather than being the frame through which you do all of your reading of literature, as seems to be much more commonly the case now. But I found it completely mind-warping to to encounter this idea that language structures reality, and therefore it's not possible to look through words at what they mean. You know, meaning's just not accessible because it's always thrown off by the force of words pulling it this way or that way. And the inference which is made by a number of at least the early deconstructionists that's been developed in some different ways now. This insight that actually to a significant extent, you know, what lives under that sort of push and pull of meaning is relations of power. And I guess the deconstructionists take that insight and come to the conclusion from it that there's nothing there. There's no stable meaning. There's no nothing. There's nothing we can resort to that will give us any firm grounding from which to encounter really anything at all. Which I find having come from an education where, for all its sort of religious eccentricity, I got a fairly recognisably classical education. Right, you know, and actually very deliberately so. You know, the Steiner curriculum frogmarches you chronologically, you know, again, and you go around, yep, this sort of hermeneutic, yep, cycle of civilizational development again and, yep, again. Yep. And every time it's Egypt, Greece, Rome, yep, the West, Egypt, Greece, yep, Rome, Christianity.
And the Jewish canon, yep, yep.
Right, and they take you through it chronologically and through from a number of different facets. And what you come out with is a sort of working model for the evolution of consciousness over the grand sweep of civilization from Egypt up to the present day. Yep. And I mean, you know, it's a pretty crude model because at the end of the day, this is just for kids, but it's a working model, right? And you can, and then I got to university and critical theory just sort of lobs this bomb into the middle of this model and says, well, no, actually none of this is stable and none of this is true and none of this actually means anything because this is all just the white hetero patriarchal logocentrist construction which has been used to entrench hostile relations of power which are oppressing you as a woman and also as a queer person and as a and furthermore is doing all of these other bad things to all of these other minorities and I suppose I mapped that onto this experience of finding myself kind of always already second class in my family, and it felt great. It felt unfair and also deeply psychically destabilizing because not only did it feel like that it was patriarchal turtles all the way down, if you see what I mean, but also there was no way out. There was no way out because I was, you know, I was left with the master's tools, and there was no way to dismantle the master's house using the master's tools because that was all there was to write with. And it sent me completely sort of, I mean, I not quite sort of psychotic break, but just definitely, you know, more than a little bit crazy. You know, it messed up my faith in my ability to communicate with other people. It messed up my ability to think in any sort of stable way about the world. But it was also, I mean, this is much more difficult to characterize and I haven't really gone into this in the book. It was like a kind of revelation as well, because it made what also opened up for me, and which I think is the great underrated insight and the great gift of the postmodern turn, was that at the time, I wasn't able to set aside this sort of nightmare vision of, you know, pervasive power relations. But if you can sort of set that aside, or at least put it in its proper place, what the postmodern turn allows you to see is the operation of meaning in shaping the world around us, the operation of meaning making as an historic process and as an ongoing live evolutionary historic process in which we are all implicated in shaping the fabric of reality itself. And that, I mean, it's very difficult to put it into words. In a sense, you just have to open your eyes and look at it. But as long as once you take the sort of nightmare goggles off that say, you know, this has destroyed my enlightenment paradigm and therefore, you know, everything's bad, that it's possible to experience that as a new way of encountering something really quite transcendent. I mean, this is all stuff which these are all conclusions I've come to since. Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, I felt like I was just staring into a sort of howling, horrifying, you know, realm of, you know, all, you know, always kind of war of all against all, if you like,
yeah,
in which I was only ever scripted to be a loser. Yeah. And that was just really unpleasant. You know, it's taken me a long time to get to a point where I can look at that dimension of reality and not find it frightening. But that's an extremely, extremely lengthy process of recovery. And I've written about it once or twice, the kind of recovery from the kind of postmodern psychic break.
It's interesting to me that beneath all of this is this, I mean, you can't have a sense of injustice that you can't have a sense of injustice. You can't have a sense of the breaking of shalom without first having a sense that things ought to be different. In other words, unlike, let's say, someone who might have lived thousands of years ago in a very different society where there was a caste or a class or a group where it was simply a given of the worldview that they would be an underclass and there would be no expectation that an injustice has been done because they were simply born to, I mean, you very much get the sense if you read enough ancient history or anthropology that that people are shaped in a very different worldview that even beneath all of this, one of the remarkable things about your writing is that I don't see a lot of people who deconstruct progress the way you do. And that's very upfront in your work, that there is in fact this layer of faith in progress, but it also seems that even with respect to the wound or the injustice that you felt, there has to also be sort of a layer of expectation that that you are not a second class person by virtue of any of these categories, whether they be female or class or whatever, but that in fact there is some rupture in of justice in the universe that is being played out in your life experience. And that's a very interesting thing, especially given a if we think about what you just described as a theological system, that there is no thing under the stuff, and it almost seems like maybe there is somehow an ought beneath the world that says women should not be second class citizens, people should not be used. And that, I think that's partly also what sort of rings through in your work that I've seen, that there is, you know, for all of the deconstructing postmodernity, you still have a cry for justice and shalom in your work.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to say. I mean, you know, let's not forget. I mean, we're sort of toggling back and forth a bit between, you know, Mary age 44 now,
right,
and Mary age 20 whatever, right, you know, back at the end of history. And you know, if I met my 20 something self now, I'm not sure we'd have much to say to one another. Maybe we would, I don't know, but you know, I've come a long way since then. For better or for worse. And let's not forget that when I was, you know, experiencing this outrage at the sort of nihilism implicit in the post-structuralist takedowns of the whole, if you like, the whole old liberal, the print era liberal system, the old liberal worldview, I was fairly sort of merrily signed up to the whole project at that point. You know, I was a progress adherent. You know, this and when the sort of postmodern turn happened to me, it wasn't that I stopped believing in any of those things. It was just that it massively complicated the project. You know, it's like you're still trying to do the same. You're still trying to do the same dance. It's just that you have six legs now rather than four, and two of them are pointing the wrong way. And trying to do something completely different at the same time, you end up tripping yourself up all the time. And yeah, this is probably too abstruse to get into on the hoof rather than in writing. But there's a sense in which that nihilistic version of the postmodern turn is it's a radically self-defeating project in a way which I think is incredibly cruel to the people who encounter it, because it not only tells you that you're created entirely by the way you're interpolated by other people, but then it also places upon you sole responsibility for creating yourself in rejection, you know, in wholesale rejection of those ways you're interpolated by other people. And yet it also says that your self-created self will only exist as such when it's validated by being interpolated by other people. So in a sense, it sets everybody who embraces it up to fail. And then it blames that failure simultaneously on every individual who fails, and also on the indestructible, pervasive systems of power which are keeping them down.
Right.
So the whole, yeah, it's not just a bait and switch. It's a really dark bait and switch.
Right. And it seems you, so as a minister, of course, we have this faith and we have this tradition and we have these practices and we have all these things, and people address them and pursue them at one level of intensity, sincerity, or another. And it seems that you really pursued the versions of redemption available within that worldview.
I did. You know, being a nerd, I set out to kind of I set out to do those things.
Right. You are a true believer.
I guess I was an early adopter of the whole sort of woke worldview, I guess. Which is, I don't know. I mean, I sort of, people are often very sort of reflexively damning about the woke worldview, and I think that's a mistake. And I think I'm generally these days inclined to give it a more charitable reading, or as charitable a reading as I can manage. Which is, and the charitable read I can give, I offer of that worldview, is that it's about the best you can muster if you want to believe in compassion and individual freedom and a desire to live well with other people and as justly as possible with other people. If you've simultaneously internalized the sort of Thatcher Reagan neoliberal anthropology that says we're all radically atomized individual. And if you're trying to believe that, and you're also trying to believe that we should be aspiring to live justly and in equality and sort of healthy, you know, healthy community with one another, you know, the woke, you can sort of see how you might synthesize something that looks not unlike the woke worldview out of that. I mean, I'd probably argue that at greater length, but perhaps you see what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, it says, you know, simultaneously everything, I must retain total complete optionality at all times, but I must also do my utmost to make sure that other people can also retain optionality at all times. And I must also have to have due consideration for the ways other people are disadvantaged in trying to secure their optionality and self-actualization. I guess I'm speaking from what I was trying to do, but I think it's a mistake to just dismiss the people who are sincerely pursuing these goals, because what they're trying to do is genuinely, it comes from good, kind, compassionate places for the most part. I mean, sure, there are grifters who are grifters, because there are always grifters, but for the most part, people who approach the world like this do so because they want to be good people.
Yeah.
I leaned into sort of liquefaction of everything. You know, I did my best to liquefy my identity, and you know, I changed my name to Sebastian for a bit. You know, I lived in various sort of communal settings, and you know, couldn't hold down a proper job. And I was kind of nuts as well, so that was probably a factor in my being unable to hold down any kind of you know, sensible, respectable job. But some of it, you know, was genuinely down to trying to be all the things which the postmodern social justice worldview said we should aspire to trying to be, you know, in service to a better world. It all just fell apart for me simultaneously.
Right.
Yeah, I lost.
Was it an incident, or was it a accumulation?
It was a lot of different things. I started to feel as though communal living. I mean, there were a number of experiences which I This wasn't just one experience, but a number of experiences which left me wondering if non-hierarchical, flat-structured community life was possible without just, you know, smuggling power hierarchies by other means. There was probably the most brutal of those was how the startup I was involved in went wrong. I mean, you know, these are people whom, you know, some of whom I'm still in touch with, so I'm sort of loath to because you unpack the gory details in the public domain. But it was a very, very painful experience. And a lot of it was my fault for being nuts and for being obsessed with power dynamics and for being nuts. But it was, I mean, it's like getting divorced. I've never got divorced, but it was as devastating as, you know, I lost everything. You know, everything that made me. You know, I lost my best friend, and I lost my raison d'être, and I lost my source of income, and I lost, well, yeah, literally everything at once. And it was, and then of course, and then the global economy collapsed at the same time. You know, within 2008. So it was like the Great Crash, but it was happening in my own life. It was awful, absolutely horrible. And I came up for air about literally like 7 years later, having totally lost my faith in progress. And yeah, I mean, that, as an experience, it left me questioning absolutely everything that I'd believed up until that point about what I was trying to do and who I was and, you know, what the right way was of trying to do it. And spent a number of years sort of questioning everything I believed and thinking, well, you know, what if actually everything is the opposite to what I thought it was before? And it turns out that not everything is the opposite to what I thought it was before, but quite a few things were the opposite of what I'd believed them to be up until now, or I could certainly make a convincing case. And I think, I mean, it was the aftermath of the Great Crash was a funny time politically, because there was a reckoning for a lot of people, and it was a reckoning for a lot of the political consensus, in ways which are very much more crystallized now. And this, of course, you know, this is well before the year of Trump and Brexit, you know, where populism sort of happened in a big way. But it was all there, you know, from sort of 2010 onwards, at least. It was just kind of rumbling in subcultures and little obscure blogs and what have you. And I mean, I can't help it. I'm a chronic political hipster. I love a rabbit hole. And I thought, okay, so actually, in a sense, the discourse collectively is going through something not dissimilar to what I'm going through personally. And I just followed it. And it led me down all sorts of interesting, you know, strange and interesting paths, and, you know, encounters with very non-standard thinkers who really challenged everything which I believed up until that point. And I came out the other side having substantially overhauled the things which I believed up until that point. You know, not to the extent of ditching everything. You know, I still hold to many of the critiques which I held to in my 20s, but I have quite a different understanding of what power is and how that works, and what people are really, and and how and why we try and do things together or not. And perhaps the other important part of that, or the other important sort of vector for rethinking a lot of this, was that I did a psychotherapy training. Although I don't practice now, I found it transformative. And one of the ways it transformed my worldview, along with being a lived, forgive the term, lived experience of going very deeply into the very micro granular detail of relationality. I mean, in a sense, that's what you study when you train to be a psychotherapist, is the minuscule fine detail of being in relation with your client. And I mean, it's a very particular frame for why you're doing that and what you're trying to achieve as the end result of that. But a huge amount of the practice is just about attention to that moment by moment experience of being in relationship with another person. And one of the ways it transformed what I'd been wrestling with up until that point was that it offers, you know, of necessity, a practical solution to the question of, is it possible to have an either encounter, which is one which is answered definitively no by academic postmodernists. Yeah, because it, I mean, in a sense, if you're an academic, you know, your social context is kind of predetermined. So you can play with the idea that it's possible never meaningfully to encounter another person, because you kind of do anyway, because you're an academic. You know, you see these people anyway, and you can play stupid games with the, you know, what's actually with how you theorize what's happening, because the social context is in a sense given. But if you're a psychotherapist, you can't really do what you do if you start from the premise that a meaning that a genuine encounter with the other person is just structurally impossible, right?
Right.
I mean, why would you take
Right.
50 or £100 an hour from somebody with whom you don't believe it's possible to have any kind of meaningful exchange? That's kind of screwed from the word go. So I mean, there's a different set of incentives for how we understand what's going on there. And although the postmodern turn happens in therapy, I imagine there's some similar challenge to what you must how ministry must reckon
Yeah.
with the postmodern turn, because in a sense you couldn't, you know, you can't be nihilistic about, you know,
Right.
even if you take on board the insights of postmodernism, you can't be nihilistic about them if you're a minister, because otherwise why are we even here?
Right.
So, you know, not quite the same thing, but you know, a not dissimilar problem. And one of the I mean, there's a number of different ways that psychotherapists have answered that theoretical problem, but one of them is in minute attention to moment by moment relationality, and the other is a much greater attention to embodiment. And again, that I mean, that's subsequently sort of percolated out in kind of pop psychology in ways which I think are not especially beneficial. But in terms of therapeutic practice, it's immensely important and immensely powerful, particularly when you're working with people with complex trauma, for example, you know, to attend to embodiment and to attend in relationship in within the therapeutic relationship to somebody's embodied experience, and also to your own embodied experience, and the ways in which those can interact with one another in a sort of wordless dialogue, you know, which can sometimes be very much at odds with the verbal dialogue which is going on. I mean, I found, but I mean, the but the central insight for me in that study and in that training was that it's just not true that nihilism is the only possible direction that you can take the postmodern insight. That's just not other answers to that problem are possible. And that led me to reevaluate. No, it just meant postmodernism stopped feeling like a kind of destructive set of insights which made the world colder and more lonely. And I began to think that I came to, sorry, I'm gonna have to find a way of saying this succinctly. I suppose I came to the conclusion that seeing those ways in which language and the historical accretions of meaning serve to structure reality didn't have to simply be a hostile operation on me. And the fact that I was implicated in that process didn't make me, it, that didn't solely make me a kind of helpless patsy in service to, you know, inextricable relations of, you know, cis heteropatriarchal domination or whatever. And that to the extent that operations of power are just an inescapable part of what meaning is and how it shapes all of us all of the time, I could relate to this as a participant. And I could relate to this as a participant and to a substantial extent as an agent, and that I didn't have to feel as though I was being destroyed in the process. And that also that opened up the space for doing so in not just alone, but in relationship to others. I mean, it all sounds incredibly abstract when I put it like this.
But not with respect to your story, because your story is very much that.
Right, exactly. And I guess the sort of the cherry on that particular theoretical cake was having a child and discovering just how deep the experience of being embodied and in relationship to other people goes when you're a mother.
The book of First Timothy, there's this passage where the Apostle Paul, this has been a passage that has just twisted some churches in knots, where women will be saved in childbirth And what's remarkable about your story is, you know, when I listen to you speak in a number of the podcasts, when I read your book, I mean, you almost put it that plainly, that the experience of having your daughter just transforms you. And given what you just said, you know, now suddenly this act and experience of agency just sort of redoes your worldview. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I should emphasize that I it's by no means my position that women are in any sense damned if we don't have kids, right?
Right. Right.
You know, other social archetypes are available and always have been.
Right. Right.
And I would never ever want to be misread as suggesting an ought rather than an is.
Right.
On that front. However, for me, it was transformative.
Yeah.
Perhaps because I'd always experienced myself as so atomized. You know, one of Thatcher's. I was born the year Thatcher came to power. You know, I've never not lived under the neoliberal order. You know, there are a great many more of us now, but I guess I was the first. I was the first generation of Thatcher's children. And you know, having an embodied experience that ran so counter to an assumption of separateness, which I'd always felt, you know, just taken so completely for granted, was really very challenging for me, and transformative, you know, and having leaned into that done my best to lean into that, which isn't easy if you have a tendency to kind of live in your head a bit like mm-hmm. I do. Yeah. I can't recommend it highly enough.
How would this have been different if you were a man and couldn't, you know, because that's...
Well,
that's...
I wouldn't have grown my daughter in my actual entrails if I was
exactly.
A man.
So is there, what are the redemptive possibilities for men who are trapped in a similar cage to what you were, or maybe just we're not because we're men?
Well, I can't really speak to that with any great confidence because I'm not a guy. I do think it's true that the problem of like the upsides of atomization are more accessible to men and the downsides are less visible. That doesn't mean they're not there at all, though. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think men just have a very different set of challenges now.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those, you know, one of those is connected to the disappearance in a high-tech society of roles which are distinctively male,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which is not, you know, that's something that sometimes gets blamed on women, you know, mm-hmm. in a sort of, you know, society is feminizing and therefore it's women's fault that men are alienated and underemployed, et cetera, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's slightly mixing up effect and cause, but it's beyond doubt that there are fewer social roles available to men now which are distinctively male. Mm-hmm. And my sense is from what I hear and from speaking to people that a great many men suffer a great deal mm-hmm. as a consequence of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a difference. That's quite a distinct set of challenges. How you go about fixing that? Well, you know, obviously not by gestating a child, because that's not something that's physically possible if you're right. A man. But how do you find your way back into some kind of relationality from that position?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have some thoughts about that, but I don't really have any definitive answers because I don't think it's for me really to say. You know, I don't think it's for me to speak on men's behalf on that front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, a number of times you've said, I was nuts. Are you still nuts?
Well, I honestly don't know if it's that I've got more sane or the world has got madder since I was in my 20s. I think it's, I think it's possible that the answer is yes, both of these have happened and we've somehow met in the middle. When I say I was nuts, I mean, I found it quite difficult to stay in relationship to other people without just spinning out in ways which are not very not very constructive. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the stuff that I was seeing was just true. I was convinced we were sort of living in the end days, you know, and a lot of the ways, a lot of the shapes which I saw the oncoming apocalypse is taking are just kind of news headlines now. So it wasn't that I was wrong. It's just that, you know, I was a bit kind of over colourful on the form and a bit out on the timeline. Does that mean I was crazy? I mean, a lot of crazy is just being radically at an angle to what everybody around you is thinking, right? I mean, there's just straight up crazy, which reads as crazy in pretty much any social context. But you know, a lot of crazy is just being very much at an angle to what everybody else thinks around you, and I was definitely that. I don't know. Am I still nuts? I find it much easier to rub along with other people now, not least because I don't have to work in an office anymore.
Mm. What do you think now? You're raising your daughter. My youngest just turned 23. My oldest is 32. I have five children, and it's quite. I was just talking to a man younger than myself who was. He comes to one of our meetings with his girlfriend and they're not married. And I talk to a lot of young men and I strongly encourage them to marry their girlfriends and have children and have a family, because I have certainly found that there have been few things in my life that have been as meaningful, as rewarding, as challenging as, in fact, raising children and launching them out into the world. And one of my children just got engaged, which was, in my opinion, way too late, but finally, good for you. Let's keep moving. you guys are a little slow. I was married and well on my way when I was 25, all the clock has sort of been set back on this generation. What do you think Mary 20 years from now would say to you now?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I have no idea. I imagine she will have some thoughts on what it's like being a woman after menopause, which I have nothing very useful to contribute to now, mm-hmm. because that's just not where I am. Mm-hmm. And you know, in as much as I've found I have thoughts on what it's like being a young woman. You know, young of, you know, of marriageable age, of childbearing age woman, you know, from the other side of the getting married and becoming a mother looking glass. I mean, this is I've framed this in one of my Substack essays as, you know, the two missing pieces of the hero's journey for women, which I think, you know, if we're going to take an embodied understanding of women's journey, the average women, again, you know, other archetypes are available, right? But for your average woman, liberal feminism is very stunted in the picture it offers of the female hero's journey, because it maps it on a more sort of single male trajectory that kind of, you know, starts at the beginning and continues and finishes at the end. And there's this idea that women's careers or women's, you know, adult lives should follow the same pattern. And in my observation, thinking about the women who I know who are mothers, actually a lot of them whom I met on doing my therapy training, a lot of them were older women whose kids had grown up, yeah. and who were embarking on sometimes their third career.
Yeah.
And it seems to me very often the case that whereas men will, you know, whereas the ideal for men is to have one career, which sort of starts here and kind of continues upwards, women will very often have three. And they map onto distinct life stages, which are to do with what else you're prioritizing in your life, which is usually caring obligations or relationships of one form or another. So, you know, you might be, you know, the kind of, which again maps onto this very old witchy archetype of the maiden, the mother, and the matriarch, you know, the maiden, the mother, and the crone, if you prefer. And I think the liberal feminism is very good at centering and representing the interests of the maiden. Doesn't have a great deal to say about the mother, except sort of as a set of logistical problems to be solved, and just, you know, would like to abolish, is terrified of the crone, or doesn't really understand how she might be a valuable or admirable or appealing figure at all. You know, she's seen as a sort of fearful end that all of us come to, or perhaps, you know, as a kind of as a third age which needs to be recouped into the order of sexy and appealing again. Whereas, speaking to older women who I know, most of them find not being sexy anymore a great relief, and are just happy to get on with, you know, embarking on their third career as a psychotherapist or whatever, and just not having to deal with any of that nonsense anymore. So there's a real kind of disjunction in what's being offered in liberal feminism, and, you know, observationally for me, what a great many normie women actually live in terms of our life trajectory. Just bringing that back as a very kind of roundabout answer to your question of what the Mary 20 years from now would think. I guess feminism against progress, you know, take in totality, is my comment as Mary the mother on some of the difficulties some of the things I wrestled with as Mary the maiden, you know. But by maiden here, to be clear, I mean the childless unencumbered young woman of childbearing age. What Mary the crone, Mary the matriarch, will have to say about my life now, I don't know. Probably, I wish you'd started having kids younger, mm-hmm. you know, and you probably. I have one. It's probably too late for me to have any more now.
Yeah.
This is a decision that I live with. You know, what can I say? I encourage all of my friends, all of my younger friends, to crack on. You know, because you never know how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't know. I think there are. I wish there were more public. I wish there were more social airtime for older women.
Yeah.
I really do, and not just as sort of dolled up, you know, plastic surgeried, you know, botoxed kind of simulacra of their younger selves, but as, you know, in all of our glorious aging, you know, postmenopausal cronehood.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's just self-interested of me, because, you know, I'm not that many years off it myself. But I feel, you know, we could, you know, pretty much the only place where crones get any airtime at the moment is in pushing back against gender ideology. And, you know, and they get both barrels for doing, you know, and women who resist, you know, as sex realists, the kind of onslaught of gender ideology are routinely traduced as old and ugly and wizened. You know, it's practically kind of horrid wizened, you know, sexless old witch. You know, it's properly medieval in its tone and its connotations.
Yeah.
And yet the crone persists.
Yeah.
There's something wonderful and heroic about that for me. But Victoria Smith, who's a friend, a British writer, recently wrote a book, Hags: The Demonization of Older Women, where she challenges, she tackles some of this and challenges some of this demonization. Although I don't know if she does it from the perspective of the triple goddess. but I feel like if she's, you know, she's one voice, contemporary voice, making the case for the matriarch or the crone, as you prefer. I'd love to see more.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting though. You also have, you live in a place where you've had two Elizabeths and a Victoria. So it's, you know, there have been women of enormous power and consequence within your world. I know we're running out of time. Anything you wanted to say or anything you wanted to ask me before I stop the recording? I'm so grateful that you were able to give me this time. It's been absolutely wonderful. Just you're such a fascinating person to listen to think, and and you've just brought some really remarkably fresh insights out into the world through your books and through all of these interviews that you've given. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I will again, thank you very much. And I'll end the recording because I know you've got to run.